morning, honourable members, ladies and gentlemen. Good morning to the a warm welcome, in fact, to all of you, especially to the honourable member from the Portfolio Committee on Tourism. You're welcome, sir. And of course, to all of you, the Director General from DILCO, and his staff with him, and of course our guests, members of the diplomatic corps present, ladies and gentlemen. A warm welcome and thank you so much. We have one apology, honorable members, from the honorable Boromisa, and there's also an apology from my good self. For coming in a couple of minutes late. And of course, on behalf of Honorable Mbonyama, for doing the same. In fact, may I inform you that I was held up right at the entrance to the garage by the Honorable Mbonyama, who for some reason, I thought he was on the phone and didn't want to go down, go in. Because he would lose his signal. Thank you so much.
May I say that the chapter is out of order?
Indeed, I am out of order. Thank you so much. Honorable members, we have two issues on our agenda for the day. One is Mali, the obtaining situation in Mali, and of course, our role. And of course, the honourable member from tourism would specifically want to know as well how it impacts on our tourism TV. Then the obtaining situation in Swaziland. Since our last briefing, there were still a lot of issues. Some things that are taking place at the time. We would like to know what the obtaining situation is now, how far it has progressed, and of course, how it relates to South Africa and the impact. DG will start with Mali, and then proceed to Swaziland. Thank you so much.
The Honourable Chair, the Honourable Magama, the Chair of the Portfolio Committee, the Honourable Members of the Portfolio Committee, fellow colleagues from the Board of Corps, friends of the media fraternity, and colleagues from DILCO. Here I'm accompanied by colleagues from our department. On Mali, I brought Ambassador Lambert. Are you sitting there? That handsome guy back there. Ambassador Limbede is a point person on Mali. So on daily basis, he looks at Mali. In fact, the whole of West Africa. That is his area of responsibility. He's the chief director in there. So he's the one who originates policy options for government. Then on Swaziland, I brought colleague Lizelle Kasema. That's a pretty young lady then. She monitors Swaziland like a soldier. She makes sure that she keeps facts on Saturday. So I brought this to extent with me in case you find me slightly inadequate. So I will refer some of them to them. The objective of this briefing is to provide the Honorable Portfolio Committee with some deeper insight into the situation in Mali and its regional dynamics. That is the role, that's what you have asked us to come to do. It will be in five parts. The first part will be the rapid overview of the regional situation and the stability dynamics in that region. Second part will be a review of the causes of the coup. The third part will be the various international processes that have taken place and that are taking place. The fourth one is the French intervention. And the fifth one is Saraga concerns. And if, before that ends, we have to make contact. Now, I just wanted to share with all members this slide. which is a very complex region. You see, those where is my friend? This thing, this is flashes. You can see that flashes all over. You can see there's fire. This is like fire. You can see it's a region with a lot of fire. From the sea, from the land, downwards, upwards. It's a very difficult region with a lot of fragile states, weak institutions. Now, this is, I think I've gone too much. Yeah. Just look at Mali, where it is. It's a very huge, one of the biggest countries, landmarks in West Africa. It passes through, it shares borders with those seven countries. So whatever has happened there in Mali, we can imagine its impact on the neighboring countries. The landlocked country. You have Libya, and you have Cote d'Ivoire, you have Mauritania, Algeria, Niger, and various countries around Mali. So that's what I wanted to indicate to you where it is. And you can see north of Mali, Algeria, then you come to Europe. And then, I want to show you this map with a lot of cross-cutting lines. And look at the red line. That is the unpacking route. The red line. That's how arms have been trafficked. You can see from Libya how the arms have moved through Chad, Niger, Nigeria. These arms. And then they move from Libya through Algeria to Mali. That's why when you said, if you stabilize Libya, you might stabilize the region. Those are the consequences of it. The second one is the drug trade, starting from the Atlantic Ocean. I think you can tell where the origin of those drugs. They come from somewhere. So they come through. Why they come there? Because if you go towards more north, there is a lot of surveillance there. Between America and Europe, a lot of surveillance. So it comes up, comes through our country. They come through Nigeria. They come through Guinea. Now understand why they come from Guinea to South. They cross through Mali. They cross through Niger. They go to Asia. They go to Europe. That is the arms trade. And then you look at the radical elements, Al-Shabaab, Hakim, Mujahid, and Boko Haram. You see the origin, that is that cattle line, from Somalia, from Algeria, from there. And now they have all converged in north of Mali, most of the radical elements. So Mali became a convergence of most of these things. So when you go through this presentation, please bear that in mind. I can bring it for a number to understand. I will bring this slide back just to refresh your mind on the routes that have been followed in this conflict. Now, play food. What's wrong with the technology? Honorable Chair, I'm stuck. Mm-hmm. Now, briefly. The deal of the coup, as I say, is going to be the next one. What has happened? This extreme conflict and instability with weak government institutions have allowed the development of various arms and drug trafficking groups, as explained to the honorable members. Now, I'm sure most of you are aware of the historical advice of the Tuareg since the formation of Mali State. But I'm going to recall that when Mali was formed, because the Tuareg wanted to have their own separate state in the north. There was this issue of this and that. You know, there was a lighter skin and darker skin. And you know, historically, the Tuareg were like the masters, and darker skins were like the subjugated. So France refused
And I'm very grateful, colleagues from the French Embassy. France refused to divide Mali along the color lines or tribal lines. They said, no, we want a unified Mali. But the Tata were not happy about that. Because I think in the process, the agreements reached were not implemented at that time. So you saw two, three Tuareg uprisings in Mali. Because even after the Mali gained independence, they did not enjoy a very strong institution in Mali. And that could not therefore manage this dichotomy, the tension between the both in the lighter skin in the south, those with the lighter skin in the north. So they could not manage that the tension. So there have been three previous uprisings of the in Mali. And they were brutally crushed by the Mali government, the leader of Brazil. So, and that is a bit of hatred. To say, look, we agreed, now you crush us. And that bitterness led to, can I say, permanent tension in Mali. And then some terrorist group, the South said, but you guys are also people of slavery. You were slaves and slaves, the Malians. So it was not only from one side. So there was a bit of, reaction from both sides, because Mali maintained that the insubordination of the Tuareg is undermined the state of Mali. But the failure to implement the peace agreement, and the situation was then worsened by the Dahab in the region. That included a lot of, especially in the north, where the Tuareg were. They got different interests, most of them. And then what they did when dislocated, they migrated towards Libya and Algeria. So they moved, they were in the north anyway, way in the north. So with the tension, dislocation, they moved to Algeria, they moved to Libya. So that's the most further place they went to Libya and Algeria. And of course, in terms of, they found it easier, the environment was very easy for them. It was almost like it's a same people. They look aligned and they shed a lot in common. Now, some people assert that the Libyan fallout gave momentum or impetus to the Tuareg return to Libya. This time with vengeance, because now they were armed. So they came with vengeance. And then they found a very, very weak Mali state. Very weak Mali state. Recall when they came back, it was just after the coup in Mali, in March. So when they started to flow down, there was instability in the south. And that instability did not assist the Malian government to keep the country together. So, and hence, you saw in the report how they shifted, just literally walked through from the north up to the middle of Mali. They literally just took this entire territory, because they moved very little from Libya, even those from Algeria came down, and some moved from Somalia, they all came down. So they took this territory in lightning speed and almost cut Mali to half. So that was one problem. At the same time, many civilians and military leaders were actively engaged in arms and narcotic trade. Now, in that confusion, as the coup happens, the Tuareg come down, we observed from reports a lot of illegal activities by some senior, very senior in the military. Like I show you, the arms trade and the narcotic trade. And these developments weakened the Somali state affair. So, then there was another group, the MLA uprising. Now, they, some of them were I think I'm sorry, better will assist us later on. Their uprising was crushed. And again, we have another group of bitter people, apart from the Tuareg. It's not an Islamist radical part of the Tuareg. It's those who can say that the genuine they're not like influenced or managed or manipulated from outside. The people say we understand can be in power, but we don't understand the way you deal with our grievances. Now, remember that towards the middle of late last year, you saw the announcement of the formation of a separate state of Mali in the north, the state of Azabab. So that is the group that will respond for that. And then the creation of that state of Mali further weakened the capacity of the army in Mali. Because what you then saw, you saw some defection, especially in those borderline countries, Mbaku in the north. You saw a lot of defection, people joining the military, in there because they were generally dissatisfied. And then we see the army itself, once they poorly armed and poorly fed and poorly living conditions. There's a lot of defection among the army. Apart from the various armies being divided, presidential units being divided from the other soldiers, from the Air Force, the whole host of division and protest. When the MLA then announced that they formed the state of Azawad, I think the neighboring Mali countries, this is what we can go on. Because what they saw, now the creation of a base of the militants from all because of life. It has money, it means they're going to move near now to the rest. Because what was then happening, you saw some of the militants now begin to move towards Niger, Mauritania, moving towards Algeria. So the operational geography of the extreme militants increase. And of course some of them started to move and join the Boko Haram in Nigeria. So people say the best thing to do is to crash, restore the north of Mali, back to Mali, and therefore disrupt the communication lines and ocean lines of this group. That is what is then led to the present arrangement. But then also was the Ajim, Al-Qaeda in the Maghreb. There's another group there, Al-Qaeda in Maghreb. Because Tuareg are not necessarily Al-Qaeda. But then you have a new group, and you have the again the Maghreb. You know, Al-Qaeda after Gnadin was killed, started releasing the live operations. You have the Al-Qaeda in the Middle East, Al-Qaeda in South Asia, Al-Qaeda in the Maghreb, and then you have Al-Qaeda units in Europe and America. So there's a decentralized operation. So you want to centralize this right headquarters to the line. So and then it was like, you guys, you find a way to survive. We'll give you basic technique, but we'll see how to survive. So all of them have to tell the Baha'i. So Ahl al-Masra became a very formidable group. Because some of them were in Libya. They got money there, got weapons there. And these are the most lethal among the groups operating there. CLS, Northern Ability, strongly ideological connected. So, you know, these are most lethal, most CLS. In fact, Boko Haram is bordering, more or less, on the, in terms of the intensity of thinking, on the Hakim. Then you have the answer at Dine and the Mujo. So these are various rebellions when they regroup themselves. It was a phenomenon that started in 2010, phenomenon where you see various militants everywhere in the world digitalizing operations. And there's a very loose structure of communication. And no longer centralized like during the 70s and 80s and 90s, you see the more decentralized. And it's decentralized according to the geography of pressure. So that if you put pressure in the Middle East, they will hit North Africa, and then you release pressure there. Then they will hit Europe, and then they will hit America, and then they will hit elsewhere. Because they're decentralized. So they spread the international community's resolve and capacity to hit that one area. So that is one phenomenon that happened. But I wanted to share with you that 6th of April became a very difficult day in Mali. And then the next development was how it can help me respond to ECOWAS. Before the third interview, they asked the president of Burkina Faso to try to engage the North. And part of our interest in that was because we had South African kidnapped in the North. It's been kidnapped now in the North. So we also get interested that Burkina Faso can intervene. But ECOWAS took this very, very serious. Because as you were saying, they were not opening in Mali, they're hitting Nigeria, they're hitting Algeria, they're hitting Niger, stabilizing Mauritania and Chad. So they did not say in God that they have to take the conversation. And AU backed the ECOWAS position that what we need now is to try to end the defecation of Mali state and restore stability. And hence they agreed on a standby force of the country to the region. And then they asked the junta then to start to make personal arrangements and restore Mali to normalcy. Remember, you recall that when the president was coup in March, it was a month before the election to take place. It was in March and April, we're supposed to have elections in Mali, like they did 2 previous years. They said, intervene and let's go back to the election. We learned that the president was coup now lives in Senegal. So Africa was mad and discussed, but then came to the AU to get the AU endorsement. And then the AU Peter Sixth Council endorsed it and then took the request to the UN Sixth Council and said maybe under Chapter 7 we need to authorize intervention to restore peace and stability in Mali. But if you do so, because ECOWAS doesn't have the capacity, the means, logistics and lifting capabilities, we hope the international community can provide them with the funding, the equipment, and the capabilities to go. What they had was political will and human resources, but they didn't have the means to pursue the objectives. That time, we just took counsel. So Sarastra and the other members were very actively involved in trying to get the UN Council to support ECOWAS and AU action. And we really have delivered that in 271. And 385, and shortly meaning that we should recognize the intervention of the ECOWAS as a UN operation so that they can then have the resources needed to sustain the intervention. Initially, the US Council rejected the plan. They wanted the plan to be accompanied by political dialogue. They wanted to have a feast. They must also wave a carrot, wave a had handkerchief. So that was then revived, you know, with the help of the AU, and the ban was then approved. And then we got the chapter 4 authorized what now is called the Hafiz. Now, every AU meeting, January summit, at the end of it, they then convened a pledging conference. The AU Chair Commission, Dr. Dlamini Zuma, convened a pledging conference to say, we cannot ask the UN everything. We as Africans, let's put something. Let's put something. The UN here will assist, but let's put something. All I remember it was in that context that the Arabia pledged $10 million to assist. But also capacitated police to ensure it was in order. What was lacking in Mali prior to this was dedicated, trained, equipped police force to ensure law and order. You cannot keep law and order with the army all the time. You need a special one. That is why we utilized them, the 10 million. Then the UN, we said it's going to provide logistical support package, but financing, I think the UN is very strong. Now we hope that we can go back to the original two-track approach. We have national negotiation, but the UN could arrive, negotiate, but not with the terrorists. What do you call the terrorists? And then if they fail, this party, let them have. So there is, we hope, an opening of the two-track on that area. So far, the first level will be 3,300 of ECOWAS international force. Some countries outside the region are also placing the force. And the UN is adamant that they need screening. Why they need it? Because they fear that there might be a violation of human rights because of the history of the region. The situation has been different. The other area that I wanted to share with you, remember, is the French intervention. I remember recalling that after the ECOWAS agreed to have a standby force, 2 or 3 months passed, nothing happened. Because there were no means, no equipment to do the work. So the transitional president in Mali approached President Holland in France and ask for help. But President Holland did something that has not been done, I think, by many French presidents. He called a number of heads of state, even my own president, Zuma, to say, I've got this request from your brother in Mali for help. What do you say? So this panel, because of a consultation by the French president to our leaders, I think all of them, they gave their go ahead that if it is this objective to bring out, to stop the advance of the Sahara in the north of Mali, to restore the territory of Mali, and then to create the conditions for the AFISMA, and then to assist to train the Malian army. You recall, I remember that last month the EU, they would send 70 soldiers to go and help retrain Mali soldiers. If that is the case, we are going to present an intervention. That is how the French send the troops. Now, here with this map, I just want to share with you who is where. You can see where the rebels are. They control that upper area. I don't know what is that color called. Is it green or what? Above Konara and there up. That's what they control in Israel. They were in Kidal, Gao, you know, Tibuki, Wen, and Nero. That's what they control, that territory. And when the French came, the operations developed, they forced the advance of. I remember by December, they referred to I Bamako. And evidence of the graph was indicating that they will reach Bamako before June this year. The state of Mali military intelligence and police, the type of equipment they used to defend, but that it was possible for them to reach Bamako before the end of this year. So when the scientists have reached, they draw a line on the fence. They say, not here. You don't pass this one. And where was the line? The line was where they went. This was the line. This was the Mali, this was the division of Mali. So they said, we'll stop here, and then begin to push upward. Start to push them out, let them out. And right now, we can see that I think a line is drawn around this area now, in Mali. So that the front of government restriction has been expanded northward. So that is the French intervention. And the idea was the French will continue liberating north of Mali. It is hoped that as they do so, the ECOWAS force will come out and take the French and colonize. As that happens, the newly trained Malian force will then take the territory that has been liberated and consolidated. As I speak now, the ECOWAS troops are in Mali. So, as Roland was saying, it's not that long. He may go out, we don't know when, end of February, end of March, but I think there's limited intervention. What we are all discussing is, can we keep the country together without French? That is a tall question the AU is discussing. If the French withdraw from north of Kidal, because this guy ran into Algeria, if the French withdraw from north of Kidal, they withdraw from here, are we going to see the push southward like before? If they withdraw from Gao, are we going to see the push from Niger? Because these guys have disappeared in the desert, in the mountains, disappeared in Mauritania, in Niger, Nigeria area. So if the French withdraw, the question we're asking is, will these guys not come back and destabilize? Now, to summarize and to end the discussion, Honorable Chair, is our concerns. Sudan's concerns are different from the situation. First of all, we encourage the international community to support and empower the African initiative. We say that even if the French help, let this remain an African initiative that will bring peace and stability in Mali. It should be under ECOWAS with the AU support. We must make sure that as we liberate parts of Mali, Malian government must be seen to be credible and be seen by its own people to be fully its own responsibility. But to do so, it must demonstrate effective governance, respect for rule of law, command and control of the military, and military effectiveness. So what has caused the issue of Mali, apart from coups in the past, was that there is no political control of the military in Mali. And that is our main concern. As a result, coup breeds lawlessness and disorder. And that breeds conditions for human rights violations. We are also worried about the probable reprisals. And this was also raised by the human rights. You saw how they were reacting, how they took to back from the rebels. The type of near vengeance, so to say, on those of capture. Or those who are supposed to support this MLNA and other movements. But also, we saw some casualties because of the French airstrikes. You can imagine that when you are in a civilian, when you are in populated urban areas combat, you will have casualties. But also we have asked, and we all know how it is possible, for the journalism access. You know, when France intervened for the first 2 weeks, since we're not allowed to move in those areas for security reasons, we can imagine, but they were still operating. And that's why we are worried about possible human rights concerns. And then we also talk about national good negotiation, because we believe that at the end of the day, society people must come back to negotiate. We hope that the danger of lack of sustainable political solution may also develop into a problem later on. We had hoped that ECOWAS will convene an all-inclusive negotiation so they can be credible and address all concerns of Malians, including the 12 history of hatred. The 56 years of hatred should be buried. Driving rebels, particularly non-jihadist groups, out of their captured areas, that can disturb political solution could lead to prolonged insurgency and unrest. Like we are saying, that it's something to win territory, but it's also important to ensure that as you do so, you reach out to other groups in the peace plan, so to say. Now, our other concern was the Bokti project. You know, this was a great project in Mali. We spent so much money in Mali, time in Mali. We rebuilt this very historic library there. You saw the big damage was shown all over the news. And so we are thinking that we should aid Mali and rebuild We are also concerned about the humanitarian situation in Mali, drought, hunger, malnutrition in the region. That led to a lot of internally displaced people. The Zimbabwean government have committed, as you recall, last year, something like 70 million rand aid to Mali. It was said a week or 2 days before the coup, but we were there together. We were together in Mali when we pledged. It was the 20th. We were minister in Bamako. 22nd, there was a coup. But we couldn't go back because there was a coup. It was the pledged man, the president, called by the AU. 2 days later, we pledged. We said, no, we'll continue. So far, in the quantum of aid delivered to Mali from South Africa, all this we bought from South Africa. They're still moving on. We're still tracking. Some are in the ship as we speak. To go to Bamako to assist people have been displaced, especially women and children. That is the brief. That is the brief on Mali. So the ambassador invited here. He will have to answer the question. Thank you. Thank you, Chair.
No, thank you. Thank you so much, TG, for this briefing. Now, honorable members, we've received briefing and our involvement in South Africa and trying to alleviate the situation on the one hand, but also to assist the process in terms of a resolution. Now, it's open for your engagement, questions, comments. Let me start with Honorable David. Honorable Jacobus, Honorable Ngonyama, and then Honorable Boy, and then go over to you down the line. Yeah.
Is it possible for us to maybe allow any addition stuff?
Oh, okay. That's fine. So, Ambassador, then.
Even this aid is under his watch, so he watches everything.
He's covered. Okay, no, that's fine. welcome, Honorable Mwango and Baba. Okay, it's fine. No additions, Honorable Jacobus. Please proceed. There are no additions.
I'm not an expert on the matter, Chairperson, so I can't add. I share, Chairperson, the concerns from South Africa based on page 10 of the presentation. especially the second last bullet point, French airstrikes causing civilian casualties. But I first propose a question. I don't know, and maybe it's probably a question for the French president to answer. The request from Mali, from France, to assist. And I think it was a good move from the Malian president to then call other colleagues on the continent to say, what do you think? That I agree with. But if one looks at what happened in Libya, and I think it was revolution 1973, if I'm not mistaken, did you correct me? 1973, where there was supposed to be no-fly zone, and at the end of the day it turned out to be something else, which it seems now is the case again, where civilian life is lost, and, you know, we agreed to let the French come in. Don't know what the interplay was, but to let the French come in. And we might end up with a situation we already have, because there already has been a loss of civilian life. And that's a serious concern. So I just want to support the concerns that, that we have as a as country. Thank you.
I listen to the situation, and as many of us are doing, the situation seems to be quite relaxed and intense. And the route to Iran, maximum support from outside, certainly from the U.S. So my issue is total commitment of the U.S. to be able to support the next level. The second one is the real further concern. Besides the issues of the history, which many countries have, and we have that situation all the resources, and in many other countries, can that situation justify the kind of incidents and killing of people and the destruction of infrastructure that we see? What are the real concerns of power? So that, yeah, the second, the last part is the removal of tribal material. So I'm sure all of us in Africa are totally worried about it, the material is too much. And is there no way of removing that material until the situation has been stabilized?
Thank you, Chair. I'll have a contrary view to that one, that Timbuktu must be defended more than removed. Because I think that's part of the purpose of our presence. Yeah, not even temporary. Let's defend them there. Let them remain there. If they create war, let's go for it. You see, I'm saying this because I go with the other question you're asking. The lack of ideological base. I mean, we don't have a sense. You talk about bitterness and talk about terrorist groups. What is the purpose? Is the ways you find in Libya where people end up striking and you end up with amorphous groupings, usurping power, and no purpose coming up of exactly why would people react in this particular way? You see? Why would people react in this particular way? Is it because of the drug? You know, in South Africa, you talk about Nyopa. And at Nyopa, people just steal your chairs and do everything fine and become more violent. Is this a present phenomenon in the 21st century where people enter into violence with no purpose? This is what Africans are doing in general. This is what is happening in Mali today. Influenced by the drug trade, influenced by the armed trade, no purpose of taking power from whom, and what informs you to take power from another African? Would you be just mere bitterness? But you're not bitter, you don't hate me because I'm Xhosa and you do that. Go to that extreme of trying to use that power from me. Is that what is exactly happening? is what I'm trying to do as I was listening to DJ to understand that what informs it, so that we do know what are we encouraging about negotiation, so that you know what type of deals we are trying to offer each other. Is it about two to two? I'm just saying that I don't have a sense of exactly why are all these terrorist groups flooding Mali and moving from wherever they are moving. What is the purpose? But it doesn't seem to be ending in Mali, in Libya, in different kinds of parts. Partly, out, if you had listened to yesterday to the women outlining the issue of violence against women in these past 3 months and rapes, you want to see if there is some comparison where there is lack of a political interpretation of the particular world that they are engaging into. And then there's just violence all over the place with no purpose. Is this what you are saying, the situation there? Then why would UN security for, I mean, and everybody flood that place when there is no real purpose or real political reasons for them to fight amongst each other? Would you be able to give us some sense of it, exactly what is creating this type of situation? So that when it comes to solutions, we don't know exactly that this is the purpose. And that people can assist us to resolve the tensions that are there. I mean, human bitterness is something that will go on for many years and many times to come. It's not easy to be resolved unless there are institutions that have a particular reason and purpose. So for me, trying to get closer to you, that what is the purpose? Sometimes terrorist groups have to be defined. Why are they there to overthrow a particular government? Is this a new phenomenon of the 21st century in the African continent? Just give me that reason.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I've got four questions. The first one, and it really relates to consistency. If I understand Resolutions 2071 and 2085, they gave authority for the African-led military support endeavor into Mali. Now, what happened was the French intervened, and we supported French intervention. Now, the Mali president, under the Responsibility to Protect Doctrine, has the right to ask a foreign power to intervene. But if it's going to be military intervention, there has to be a UN Security Council resolution to approve that. Now, I don't see any UN Security Council resolution here supporting French intervention. And yet we supported French intervention. I want to say this, I completely agree with French military support and intervention. But you see, here's the thing. We can't stand by UN Security Council procedures in certain terms of certain countries and not others. So we've got to be consistent in our approach. When we talk about UN intervention or foreign powers intervention in Libya or in Syria, or wherever, we insist on a letter of law being followed. In respect of Mali, we didn't follow the letter of the law. We accept the French intervention, notwithstanding the fact that there wasn't a UN Security Council resolution. That Security Council resolution, 2071-2085, endorsed an African-led intervention. And there are two different things there. But I want to repeat, I actually do support French intervention in this context. But I'm just looking at the South African position and the consistency of approach in that regard. Second of all, just clarity in respect of that which has been pledged. You say we pledged 10 million rand for FISMA to capacitate the peace force. And then the next point is we rejected finance but agreed to a logical support package. Are those two entirely different things? And if that is the case in terms of the logistical support package, then of course we see greater detail of that later on, but it's sort of clarity in that regard. The next point, what was required was a two-track approach to the situation. National negotiations with non-terrorist elements. Now, that's all about negotiating itself. I mean, if the problem is caused by so-called terrorists, then you're going to resolve the problem. You're going to have to negotiate with them. Otherwise, you don't solve the problem. So I don't understand the context of that resolution and why we went along with a resolution which bound the process to not negotiating with terrorist organizations. I mean, for heaven's sake, to solve the problem, we have to negotiate. They have to negotiate with terrorist elements. Otherwise, it's going to be another Afghanistan. And thirdly, which is my final point, I don't understand if there's an exit strategy. More particularly, I suppose the French must look after themselves, but in terms of ourselves, our involvement there, we're giving 10 million rand to FISMA. I mean, is this bringing the end of it, or do you think this is going to carry on because there doesn't seem to be an end in sight?
Mostly cut, but there's a few points I just want to raise and I just want a bit more clarity on. So one is the different movements that's operating there. What have they got in common? They must have something in common because they cannot fight. If they fight for the same thing, it's no use. But of course, dogs fight about a bone. Who's going to get the bone? What do they actually want there? Or is it drugs that's behind it? Because I cannot see that so many terrorists can work together. That I would like to know. The other thing is, the first thing is $10 million that we're given. Was it ring-fenced? Have you got any idea where the money is going to? What are our pros and cons? And what is it? What was that $10 million exactly for? Was it in aid? Was it in training for the army or what? And then other, the humanitarian $70 million that was given. Are we sure that that money went to the right places for the people, or was it... Is it left in somebody's pocket? How can we be sure of that? And then I would like to know about the elections. I have to agree with my colleague. It's no use. We have the World Cup here, and we have to negotiate with the terrorists to have a peaceful World Cup. So how can they negotiate, election? Not taking their people in consideration. It will be a never-ending story. Thank you. That's all I want.
Thank you, Chair, for allowing me. The first thing, let's make a comment, an observation. The mere fact that we have the French with boots on the ground in Africa is an indication that the African Union, especially the peace and security organ, lacks purpose and efficacy, that we're just merely reactive and not proactive. That is a clear indication of the failure of the African Union to do its job. Yeah. Having said that, I just wanted to reiterate what the Honourable Smuts said earlier. Indeed, the country and the people of the country invested heavily in the restoration of the manuscripts in Timbuktu, and we made a huge contribution. I'd like to know what the current status of those manuscripts are. Where are they, and what is the status? And possibly, to repeat what he said with emphasis, instead of us planning to invest in restoration of the building, of the library, etc., given the fact that the situation is unstable and severe, and it's volatile, would it not make sense to put these manuscripts in safekeeping somewhere in a safe location until such time that the situation stabilizes? I heard what the Honorable Bui said about defending Timbuktu. What that would mean, do you have any intention of putting boots on the ground, South Africa? Do you have capacity to do that? I don't think so. If you look at our situation in other parts of Africa where we've been peacekeeping, I don't think we have the resources to actually get involved with the boots on the ground. Yes, we have invested $10 million. The question is, do we have any plans to invest in the future, in any process of DDR or the demobilization, reintegration, whatever that process is? Do we envisage a role for ourselves then? And what will the African Union do? Will the African Union come to the table financially in any other way? Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Jay. The present political situation in Mali, the government, it's not a legitimate government, it's a legal government. Can you give us more information regarding the present government in Mali, the corrupt system? Because I don't think it was a coup d'etat. So, but who thinks really in control of Mali? And I would like to know the African AU, what plans do they have so that we can have elections in Mali, so that you get the more acceptable government. Thank you, sir.
No, thank you. Any other honorable? Okay, let me perhaps just raise one question really around the French intervention and its implications. Now, I think in the same spirit of Honorable Davidson, while the French intervention in Mali is welcomed, it is a matter of concern, great concern for that matter, because intervention itself is fine, but it is indicative of a deeper and broader problem. And it is that of the inability of African leaders to take responsibility for the fortunes of the African continent. It's a lack of commitment. Look, we know about African countries that are poor and so on. But it is incredible when you hear about the personal fortunes of the head of state on our continent. You know, in spite of the difficulties that their countries may experience at any given time. And in fact, if you look at the figures on which they spend money on military equipment, it's incredible for poor countries who can't even pay AU membership subscription. It's incredible. Of course, some really have those problems. Some indeed do. But it's a matter of concern, DG. And surely, you see, it places us in a very difficult position, where, especially after we've scored a historic victory with the passing of Resolution 2033, which really gave, the AU a legal standing. You would note in the past, in fact, the Security Council never saw it necessary to engage with African Union as a regional body. So following, of course, the experiences in MENA, in particular the interventions in Cote d'Ivoire and Libya, and the subsequent passing of Resolution 2033, that situation changed. But, you see, if we, and my concern is if really we are seeking to build an independent Africa in the true sense of the word independent in particular from our former colonial masters, and beginning to give effect to the phrase or to the credo of African solutions, African problems, then we must shoulder the responsibility. This, I think, my own view really is, I think this was a biggest failure of leadership on the part of the African continent in taking responsibility for what was happening in Mali. ECOWAS is a very strong body in spite of the differences that they have among themselves about some issues, but they are a very strong body, probably one of the strongest in the African continent, the sub-regional bodies, and that they, that the Malian president had to request, for French intervention. Safe to say, it's not such a good reflection on our African leaders. In fact, it is an abdication of our responsibility. Now, your thoughts on that, and perhaps some any new information that would clear up the fog in that regard. Okay, Tiji, over to you.
Thanks, Honorable Chair and honorable members of the Portfolio Committee, and Honorable Shah from Tourism. I will share this question with Amara Limbed. But there are two main issues that honorables have raised. First, the capacity of Africa to deal with its own problems. And secondly, the way we request assistance from abroad in Africa. Members, let me go back a bit. First of all, we shared with members this map just to indicate how complex, how difficult that situation is. Just in case the who plays what role, who does what in Mali. In fact, for the whole Sahel, for the entire Sahel, it's 22.09. The entire Sahel, from Egypt, Libya, Algeria, Tunisia, and you come back, the whole Sahel, I try to indicate on members, is a region of fire. A huge instability in that region. That is one. I think that is not sure. Secondly, most of them are weak governments, weak states, no institutions. They've been free for 50, 60 years. The truth of the matter is that they've got weak institutions. Most of them could not survive in the past without the French assistance. They couldn't. So for the last 50 years, maybe again a reflection of the leadership in the continent. But as a bureaucrat, I cannot pass judgment on the leaders. I have to defend them. So this is my job. But all members, it's your duty. You can address it anyhow. But expect me to choose my words very carefully. So that I can keep my job. But this is the problem. The lack of focus on building institutions of government. The lack of attention to making sure that people feel they are free, they have a sense of belonging, they buy in on the process unfolding. That's why we normally reflect back in Saragossa, we've done so much to make sure that our people have a sense of feeling, belonging, and therefore obligation to defend the state. The third question. That region, if you look at it, you have Sahara Africa, you have Europe, it's a belt of states with a particular religious orientation. In many cases, they are Africans, yes. In some cases, they are Middle Eastern. Even all the decisions that you take among the states, can still be discussed elsewhere. The third element is the lack of coordination to address the problems of insurgency in the continent, especially in that region, the Maghreb. And lastly, the way we dealt with Libya is now haunting us. It's haunting us. How it is continuous. And it's not going to end now. It's going to go on sometime. Because Libya itself is unstable. Tunisia is finding difficult to settle, and so is Egypt. So you understand, remember, that for some time we are going to have a fairly unstable region with an impact on the overall African stability. So that is the first one. The second one, honorable members, the EU confirmed that ECOWAS have its blessing in dealing with the Mali situation. It took time for ECOWAS to put that force together. It took time to assemble AFISMA put together. It after the countries pledged the military, they say we have no means to carry out these objectives. In the meantime, Malian territory, one by one, was falling in the hands of the insurgents. As ECOWAS was taking time, town after town was falling, and they were going down to the south of Mali. So you can see the prisoners started to touch emergency buttons. because as well I'm with my brothers, but by the time they arrive, there'll be no money. We will be gone. So what do I do? I have no other objective to call my French friend and say, look, although AU says I go ahead, although I do this thing, I don't have power. In the meantime, there was a discussion between ECOWAS and the UN to give support. ECOWAS, with American support, when we were still at the Security Council, went to argue at the Security Council for Chapter 4 to authorize, and then to beg a cause for that, like elsewhere in the continent or in the world, where the UN has agreed on intervention. So as parallel to the idea of putting a force together in the UN process, these are two-track processes. In fact, we should make sure that we can behead the ECOWAS differently from continental. We can have, as Dr. Wilson was saying, a UN go ahead. And those resolutions were initially meant for that. But there was a problem within ECOWAS. Let's be truthful. There was a problem within ECOWAS. ECOWAS says to Mali, welcome to Bamako. We take over. We then control the military from there. Mali says, no, you can't. Never. Come to Bamako? No, you can't do that. You go to the north, not to Bamako. You can't change administration and put us under different provisional or whatever. No, you can't. So there was a tension between ECOWAS and Mali. There was an agreement between ECOWAS and the UN. So this completed this picture further as to what we do. Until I think ECOWAS understand that we need to leave this provisional transitional government in Mali to govern, to do its work. Their task is not to rebuild Mali's territory. Their task is to go and restore Mali's territorial integrity. So after that agreement, in fact, Mali stopped at the UN, didn't agree with ECOWAS at the UN, Mali, on the ECOWAS suggestion to take over. Because they understand the role of outside support is to ensure the territorial integrity of Mali, but not interfere with how Mali is governed. In this ensuing debate and discussion, honorable members, the Tuareg and the groups in the north gain more and more territory. And you can see from the reports from our missions, uncertainty in Bamako in the south. Panic ensued. And that's why I think the president, in his wisdom, understanding all these different things, says to the French, can you come on this limited and focused intervention? So the French president, I want to repeat, then called the regional leaders and says, you are brave. Is asking us to come in because it's taking ECOWAS a lot of time to put the troops on the ground, and yet the territory is being lost. So we can intervene, stop the advance, push them back with the hope that the ECOWAS troops will be on the ground while they're still there. So that as we exit, they take over. That's how President Holland agreed on the intervention with Mali, even without the U.S. Security Council. And that is how our heads of state agreed on the request of President Holland that can he move his troops in. So the contest, the honorable members, could have followed the normal U.S. Security Council resolution, could have formalized, but I think everybody was, even ourselves, when we do that situation, by the time you agree, Mali should have collapsed. And if Mali collapsed, we are afraid of Senegal, we are afraid of other countries further half us, because you could see this movement to us. We're also afraid that Nigeria will be highly destabilized. So looking into this unstoppable forward movement,
Amr Mbede will tell you that Mauritania is very fragile. Niger is on the brink itself. And then Guinea is cool. Now you could see there was going to be a link between the Tuareg and those in Guinea, and the entire Gulf of Guinea was going to be turned in another Sudan, about another part of Africa. So if it allows us to go further down, to keep on moving down, we're going to Guinea, we can rejoin them. And then you then have a route to the sea. We are thinking of more destabilization. So maybe all our members is a list of the evils for the French intervention, given the potential complex development going forward. However, we do agree with you that perhaps it could have been under U.S. concern. Well, when the French moved in, we are no longer in the security, we are now under U.S. concern. So we could not influence the text. But however, we continue to say, at the end of the day, Africans have the obligation and responsibility to keep the peace at the lead of the continent. And that is why when was that impromptu pledging conference at the end of the summit in January, President asked our minister to stay behind. She was already going to the airport. She was asked to go back because there is a pledging conference. And let's see how we can assist. In that conference, when Honorable Davidson, we understood that the UN is a bit reluctant with the pocket, with the envelope. The envelope was really tight, Honorable Davidson. He says, now, guys, you can go. We can give you means, but money, not now. So we said, we need ECOWAS to move like yesterday. And the only way to do is we have to put our money where our mouth is. It was that pledging conference, our members, that really helped, that, as we say now, ECOWAS has started to move into Mali. We could not wait for the UN to put the money because it was very clear that the UN will take a bit of time to move. So that is the question that I really wanted to address. Then the issue raised by Honorable October, as I say in short, Takobo. We raised a concern of the casualties because we knew it was going to be an urban type of warfare to dislodge them from the cities. There is no way you cannot have casualties. So we knew. We don't know to what extent. We just sent our people there, people in the hospital, but we don't know the extent. So we raised this concern with the French to say, yes, much as we agreed, but please let's be careful of the human suffering. They suffered enough because of drought, because of Tuareg, because of attack. The name is lodged. Let us not aggravate the situation. But I can guess that in that type of situation, it is not easy to do so. But we have noted your concern, Honorable Jacobus. Honorable Naman, you know, there is a commitment to the Executive Council. You could see from the very beginning, really it was to... But you see, I think the P5 was says, you guys, you blame us for Libya. And now you say we have armed them. Because you said, you know, those guys are armed. Who dropped the arms in Libya? Who can account for the arsenal that was dropped there by NATO in Libya? Nobody's accounting for those arms. What we see is that they took out of money. It's gone. So I think the P5 was a bit of soul searching. As we were saying, that they put a lot of conditions, and we tried to summarize them, those conditions. He said, maybe the how write it on that slide. Yeah, we give you logistical support package, but maybe not finance. You guys must put the finance. Negotiations, we agree on resolution 2071 and 2085. We must negotiate. But negotiations means one thing. With who? We don't negotiate with what's called extremists, with Akim, with Al-Qaeda, with Arab groups. No. You can negotiate with the genuine people institutions, but they're not going to bring Akim into a negotiation table. So there was a clear understanding with whom you must negotiate. That's what you just need to cancel a decision. And say, look, if you negotiate, they don't come to the party, you can go ahead. I don't, it's a very good word in Africa, but I don't want to call it in the parliament. But I can use that African word, start with an M and with R. So you can go ahead. So it was a tough talking, I must say. Why tough talking? Because the U.S. felt that, you know, we're putting soft class on dealing with this guy. Soft class. So they want us 3 years ago of the build-up of our team is in the Sahel, the U.S. They want us. But I think we're all preoccupied with the Arab Spring, all preparations happening there, and we didn't pay much attention to the warning in that area. So I think ordinarily, like you were saying with Ronald Davidson, we should have had a better resolution, I think. I'm going to mention you a question of Tuareg, because also Ambassador Honor talked about it. What is the real hope? Is it history? Is it cultural, religious tension, north and south? I will leave that to Ambassador Lembede to deal with it. Could remove the archives? You know, there was discussions. What do we do with the archives? We have asked for Ambassador Mugow in Mali to go and see and give us a state of affair. Now that at least Mali have restored the what you call it. How much is left there? We also have to talk with our national archives. You know, we trained Malian here, you recall yourself. We brought a lot of them here. We have some material we borrowed to Qatar. We opened a huge museum. So we thought we can have an inventory of how these archives, where are they? Do we have a copy here in South Africa or not? So I think it's an issue that our members, we are saying we must follow in our question. We have thought that we have to put money aside and continue that, with that project of restoring the richness of the African history, the Mali question. So I hope our government will agree that we put resources aside after we have compiled the inventory of the archives. Now, Honourable Boy, what is the purpose of the MLA? What unites all these groups in Mali? What is the objective finally? Is it a free, democratic Mali, or what? I'm not really better to answer that question, but I can imagine where we sit. With a different agenda. You see, what we don't have, and what are we saying to the countries? None of them have what you can call the Charter of Rights, some basic document that embodies the future we would like to work on. None. They don't have convincing. It was the same thing with the TNC in Libya. We said, but do you have something? Is there a charter, is there a document in which you talk about the type of Mali you want and work towards you? We have that document. How do you know that they want Islamic Mali? Yes. And beyond that, what? So we don't have that on our point. And that's what complicates even negotiation, because when you negotiate, there are certain basic things that you are looking for. And the negotiator can then have to bridge the gaps, but I'm not sure. Maybe I'm not better knows better on what is the purpose of this uprising. But what did you know? What we know is that Mali is bleeding. There are a lot of wounds in Mali running through many regions, many people for many years. The pledge of $10 million dollars. Honorable Davidson, as I said, it was a response to the situation then raised by the AU chair commission. and then by ECOWAS to say this at least. We have not reinvented the project to say for this. What we do say was that, what do you call it? January? What do you call it? January. I speak better French. So we said, no, we need to equip them. Because our worry, I remember, is law and order. That's our main one. Yes, suit can fight, suit can do this, but we must maintain law and order. To stop this acrimony, vengeance, etc. So let's equip them and make sure we law and order. Because all in our back mind were the issue of elections, which one of them would have asked about. What are we doing with the election? Now, some were saying, let's have elections in the territories that can have elections. And then as we feel about, we can have elections. But let's say from the south of Timbuktu, there is more or less law and order, and then we can have elections. And then we can then deal with those in the north later on. He said, we thought, Mali, let Malians decide. Let Malians decide whether it is the best of dealing with it. Or Mali rescue its territory, and Malian government have jurisdiction over the entire territory. And then you have elections, which, among other things, we have addressed the question of reconciliation. In which process, you have to pledge to address fundamental grievances of all Malians, irrespective of origin and geography, that you pledge to do so. So the political manifesto party must begin to indicate how to deal with the Malian question. So there's a different school of thought, even in Mali itself, but maybe Ambrada Lembeta will assist us. Now, Honorable Shah, the issue of bit of manuscripts, as I say, we are not sure how they are now, unless if Honorable Lembeta will come back and say they understand how the state of the manuscripts. Now, the role of South Africa. What we normally do, like we're doing now, board members in Somalia, we made a court, we gave a court funds. A court is at a unit now on the ground in Somalia, where we have the question of dialogue, constitutional legal processes, question of reconciliation, peace. So if Mali requests, like Somalia did, we hope we can make a modest contribution into that. What else do you know about the elections? What plans are there? I'm not sure, but I think I'll let you reflect on it. Well, I don't know, I understand your frustration on this capability for us to deal with our own affairs. That you can never deal in countries in West Africa. Strong armies, but you have to wait for a small country in Europe to fly past African countries, put its own sons and daughters on the ground, drive to the north, and so when in the neighborhood of Mali, seven African countries, eight African countries, with army, could have just moved in and stopped. But you have to ask people to live a cold winter in Europe, into the heat of Africa, to rescue the continent. I think you can reflect on the way I chose cold and heat deliberately to indicate that young people have to adjust from minus 10 in Europe to plus 37 and fight. And then the people waiting on the sidelines, the neighboring African countries. But we do hope that maybe the rejuvenated AU can create capacity. We have to hope that this regional standby forces, which everybody say we must have, that can be very active, not only in name, but can be more active. Well, okay, if you don't mind, can I give Alan better just another 2 minutes to complete the answer?
Sorry, thank you. I asked for the map to be up here. To deal with the real concerns of the Tuareg in Mali. That is the first one of the questions that was asked initially. Well, what increasingly is becoming clear in West Africa is that they all have a similar problem, and it's called the Northern problem. Almost all the countries have the Northern problem. All their capitals are in the South. All, without fail, Nigeria, Ghana, Ivory Coast, Guinea-Conakry, Guinea-Bissau, Senegal, Mauritania, Niger, they're all in the South. And they hardly venture to the North. They have no control over the Northern part of all their countries. Some of them are not even linked. You have to fly to another country to go to the Northern part of your own country. So there is no governance or control in those parts. And that's what creates this animosity and problems. And the loose groupings that feel alienated and isolated, and they demand autonomy. Almost all of them. That's Nigeria is the same. They even have this arrangement that we have a president from the north, and the next 10 will have to be from the south, which has created this problem because you have had the president from the south taking over from another president from the south, and the north is very unhappy about it, and that is why you have the problems in Nigeria now. They've broken a golden rule of sharing this. So all these countries have the northern problem. This is accompanied by religious affiliations. Almost all the northern parts are Islamic, and southern are Christian. Upper West Africa, almost all the northern parts regard themselves as part of the Arabic Maghreb. There are more Arabs, like the Tuaregs. They regard themselves more as Arabs than sub-Saharan Africans. So that adds a lot as well. And the Sahel belt straddles from Atlantic Ocean to the Red Sea. It goes across, if you look at it, it's immediately below the Sahara Desert, which divides the north and the west. All the countries from Mauritania across Mali, the northern parts, Niger, Chad, as you see in the map, right up to Somalia. That is the Sahel belt. It's the desert. It's a no man's land. It's not controlled. So that's where all the activities take place, like human trafficking, massive trafficking, kidnapping, the lawlessness in that belt. That is where they are all congregated, and that is where most of them operate. So I've dealt with the northern problem. Now, there's also the issue of territory, which I dealt with, that people feel that they're isolated, so they want autonomy. Drug trafficking, human trafficking, as well as a major problem. There are religious differences. And also below, along the Atlantic Ocean, there's a massive problem that is in the offing, the Gulf of Guinea. Most of the operations that were in Horn of Africa, piracy and everything else, moving towards the Gulf of Guinea. So the problems are all going to be on the northern side and the southern part of West Africa. They are experiencing those serious problems. Almost all those countries, without exception, have very weak institutions. It's so easy to overthrow governments. Almost all of them have experienced coup d'etats, and almost all of them, at one stage or the other, were under military rule. That's what is common among them. I think I've dealt with that issue as far as I can understand it. So the real concern of the Tuareg in Mali was basically based on some of the things that I've mentioned. But now we have these all different groups, some that are called terrorist groups. Among them, there is the MNLA, which is the Movement for the National Liberation of Azawad, which is the oldest and the most genuine, which is a real Malian organization that operates there. They have one called Mujao, which is about jihad and unity and togetherness, which also is made up of Malians, but is led by a Mauritanian general. Jaho also has affiliations with the Aqim, the Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb. There's Ansarjin, which is also part of Ujjal Madian, the red, with extreme Islamic leanings, which is part of the Al-Qaeda. And we have a number of other small organizations, mostly led by Algerians. One of the most brutal ones, which is led by an Algerian called Mukhtar Al-Mukhtar, one-eyed general who has been involved in almost all the wars in the part of the country. He was responsible for the kidnapping that took place recently in Algeria, in that oil gas installation. It was led by Mukhtar. He's an Algerian, and most of the smaller groupings that the French are fighting now are led by Algerian fighters. They are desert fighters. They know how to fight in that part of the world. So that is the kind of, in terms of negotiating with them, that the question was that how can you choose? You can't negotiate only with your friends and isolate you as your guardian enemies. That has been a problem because they had appointed the president of Burkina Faso to be the facilitator of the process in Mali. And he was assisted by the president of Nigeria, President Jonathan, as the co-facilitator. And according to the president of Burkina Faso was consistent in that you have to talk to everybody. And when he started his facilitation, he invited all the groups. Ansarjin was there, Nja was there in the talks. There was unhappiness about it from especially the Western powers. But he tried. And he has been sort of sidelined now. He's no longer as influential as he was supposed to be. But that's the two-track approach that the United Nations Security Council resolutions insisted upon is what really created the confusion as well, because ultimately it was a compromise resolution between France on one hand and the United States and its partners in the EU on the other hand. France was insisting that they go in there, they fight what they termed terrorists, and the other says no, it must be two-track. Deal with it politically first. There must be negotiation. And although clean the Malian forces before you even think about military intervention, there was talk that the military intervention was going to happen sometime in September. The ECOWAS was not happy with that decision. France was not happy with that decision because they saw the danger that if you wait too long, it's going to happen. But that was the UN resolution, and that was the resolution that South Africa actually voted for. Because we also strongly believed in the issue of negotiating while you also do not take the issue of military intervention on the table. What happened thereafter when France went in and did what it did, I think everything was overtaken by events. The resolution, if you read the resolution 2085, you can tell that by now we'll still be talking about what there's to be talk about what are the African forces going to do, who is going to go there, how are they going to, they're still going to draw up plans, and all sorts of things. That is what Resolution 2085, if you read it, that's what it says. And every 60 days, they'll go back to the Security Council and report on how the progress of the planning goes. That is every 60 days. So then it's only then after when the UN Security Council was satisfied, was going to authorize military intervention. So that was that was the situation. And when the president of Mali approached the president of France and asked for the assistance, it was because of it. And there's another point that I think I may need to clarify, because I've heard President Zuma discuss it in a number of platforms. They said that South Africa supported the French intervention. I don't think it's correct to put it that way. South Africa had no objection to... I'm not playing around with that. No.
Ambassador, you're working the diplomatic title. Now you don't do that in the community.
all I'm saying is that we did not say we support you. That we never said it. They were being briefed. Orlando was not asking for authorization. He was telling them what he was about to do. But after phoning them, he intervened 2 days later. So based on the request by president of a sovereign country, we could not say to him, no, don't go there. I think that's what I'm trying to explain. So the impression must not be created that we say one thing on Resolution 1973 and say something different on Resolution 2085. That is the position. What President Zuma said is that he was appreciative of that he took the trouble to phone him and explain to him what he was about to do. And that is what I'm saying. At least I just wanted to clear that aspect.
That war is peace by other means.
That's for the politicians. Okay, let's the DG has dealt with the status of the ministers in Timbuktu. There was a question about what can tell more about the present government in Mali. The president of Mali, President Touré, was overthrown on the 21st of March last year by a coup led by Captain Sanogo of the Mali military. And he then assumed power as the president of the country immediately after, but he was pressured to step down and a transitional government was put in place. The transitional government was led by President Diankunda Traore, who is the current transitional president in Mali. He in turn appointed Sheikh Mohamed Diarra as the prime minister. So both of them led the transitional government. A few months ago, the president Traore was seriously assaulted by a mob that attacked him at his palace, and he had to be flown to France and spend some time there recuperating. And about a month or two ago, Captain Sanogo was responsible for the coup, also forced the Prime Minister Diarra to resign from his position, some say at gunpoint. He was taken out of his house and taken somewhere else and forced to sign a letter of resignation in front of the television camera, which he had done. And subsequently, another prime minister has been appointed in his place to serve under the government of President Traore. So that is the situation. There are talks, as the DG has pointed out, of possible elections coming up in July this year. But I think it will all depend on the on the situation on the ground. They have said that there was an insistence, as well as the resolution 2085 insisted that it has to be a political resolution, there has to be elections. So whether it will go to happen, we don't know. I think those are some of the questions that I've thought of. The AFISMA, the group stands for African-led, intentionally supported force in Mali. Mission in Mali. So that which also opens the window for a foreign force to get involved in Mali as it did for France. And because the resolution itself leaves a little window open. I'm just explaining. Thank you. I hope I haven't overstepped my line.
No. Thank you so much, Ambassador. You've cleared up the a lot more things. Now, I want to take the last round, but with a strict provision that members need to be very short. We still have another outstanding briefing, and we're running the risk of running behind. In fact, we are already lagging behind with our time. So please be short, concise, to the point. Now, there was a request from Honorable Skosana for a follow-up, and then Honorable Jacobus, then Honorable Wanyama, Honorable Ilof, and yeah, that's the rest. Okay.
To your relief, Mr. Chairman, I am covered. The ambassador and colleague have actually covered me in the answer.
Thank you, Chairman. It's not a question, but if I may, through you, just address briefly the DG. There was a word that you did not want to say and wondered whether it was parliamentary or not. Now, that word forms the basis of assorted coffee. And in Afrikaans, as you know, it's called moer koffie. So it is parliamentary to use the word.
The issue, Chairperson, is ECOWAS, in my view. It's clear that ECOWAS is not as strong and as tenacious and cohesive as we thought. And because if we look at the history of their intervention, for instance, in places like Cote d'Ivoire, in my view, it's clear that ECOWAS is not as cohesive as we thought. I'm not sure at this level what is it that we need to say, and as parliamentarians, what kind of say, whether is there any thing that we can do as members of parliament to register our concerns about and the lack of speedy intervention and decision-making by bodies, in particular ECOWAS, in a situation like that. And that opens now for interventions by other forces, precisely because ECOWAS is not strong and cohesive. The UN Security Council, I seem to sense some inconsistency in their intervention and their decision-making, Chairperson. That UN Security Council, if you look at situations like the Iraq intervention and the Libyan and the situation as it was suggested, and you look at the situation that we have currently in Mali, it does appear to me that there is inconsistency. I'm not very sure. I don't want to move to the point of talking about their interests, the interests of big powers. But thanks to the intervention, in my view, of France in that situation, having consulted and with Africa, thanks to that. Otherwise, we would have a situation that is a crisis point in Mali, which would be very, very difficult and for Africa to turn around. However, I'm not sure, again, what is it that we need to do, Chairperson, and to raise our concerns as this small body of the parliament here about the inconsistency of the UN Security Council. I think at some point we need to debate this issue so that we make a very big noise about it. Because if we just accept the inconsistency, they will continue to do this. I mean, in Libya, it was quick intervention because they had particular interest. In Iraq, quick intervention because there was particular interest. Now, here is the country. In Africa, clear with a democratic process which was in place, but lack of intervention by UN Security Council. Thank you, Chair. I'm sorry, maybe I've taken a bit of time. Sorry.
No, she was representing me, Chairperson. No, I'm not discovered. I'm going to come. No, Chair, you know, in the reluctance of Honorable Smart to say what should we say as an institution, I don't think we should really welcome the briefing by the department. It's a well-informed, and quite detailed information they've given us. And it does lay the basis for us to say that as parliamentarians, because we also keep our eye on the pulse, we can't say that they are going wrong here. We need to give them more encouragement, more endorsement, that they are on the correct path. And if you say that, it then means that it gives them more confidence to continue. And we do believe the information they've given us, because you can't become complacent in what they've told you. They've given us the honest reflection of what is happening around Mali, and the type of information is helping us. Yet it does raise a lot of questions in the way Honorable Smart is outlining them. But it doesn't say that the members of parliament, we shouldn't accept it, that this is the correct reflection and the state of things that are happening in Mali. It does have challenges for our foreign policy in how we conduct it. But we should begin to concede that the world is changing. The UN is not going to be able to handle the situation the way we want, given the historical background. But South Africa is under pressure as a country to begin providing leadership in the African continent. It has developed the leadership provided by Nkosazana Dlamini in the AU. Because as long as we lead that particular boat, we are going to face this type of challenge, that we are engaging with different countries, sometimes that are not really stable, but South Africa will be forced to react and give leadership. And we can't be found to be ambiguous about that leadership. The pressure is upon us here. And if you don't look from that particular direction as South Africans, we are going to continuously point fingers to the UN without taking leadership ourselves. For me, that is the biggest question, Honorable Smart, you must answer. How do we provide leadership? And within that leadership, do we put money behind it? Or do we put slogans? Or do we say we're looking for an African renaissance that will never happen anymore? This is what we are faced with at this particular period. And it's under our leadership that we need to concede that Africa is beginning to slip. It's either we encourage that or take decisive leadership ourselves here and support that leadership to say that we put our money where our mouth is and we continue providing leadership. It will be difficult sometimes. We want to consult at the parliament. As you could listen, that's why I was saying that the ambassador is being honest to say that we couldn't object to France as we were being consulted. That's the word that is being used there. But after that, we need to adopt that type of initiative that has been taken and not walk away from it. That's all I want to ask. Let's not walk away from it. That's why you have to. No, you don't have to object. You can make it
possible. No, okay. Sorry.
Yeah. Because I was just saying that we need to take that type of reflection very strongly. Okay. I might not be using the correct time, but I'm just saying that let's reflect on it as parliamentarians. Because in a few years to come or down the line the budget is being reviewed, it's going to come back on that. And we need to reflect upon that.
Okay, Honorable.
Don't worry, I'll just ask questions. The first thing is a law and order. There's no law and order, and we give 10 million to them. I think I know where the money went to, with all those regime changes and all that. I think in the future, we must ring fences and know what it's for. If you use law and order and you send people in to go and educate them and teach them how to see that law and order going on, that's fine, but not just giving an open check. Second question, is there any other countries involved financially that are backing up all these other forces? Number three, this is a very good presentation, but in the future, can you just put after every abbreviation, you know, just say what it means. Thank you very much.
Okay, perhaps just quickly before you, I think that was the one question that wasn't clearly responded to, the question of ring-fencing. Who receives, perhaps the first question is, who receives the money, the $10 million, and is it ring-fenced?
Thank you, sir. Well, yes, yes, one of my questions and concern was about putting money in a place where there's no order. Anyway, Chair, it is true that instability in one part of the continent is bound to have an impact in some way on the other part of the continent. I was wondering, given the fact that the whole Sahel region, as we've seen in Somalia and in Mali, all these areas are now involved in civil war and terrorism, all of those things. Do we have, now I'm not saying we don't, but I would like to hear a cohesive policy vis-a-vis that region. Do we have a cohesive policy
something that we can say, this is South African policy now vis-a-vis those areas? Or is it just we react according to situations? Because obviously policies, foreign policies are guided by, some considerations, economic, political, some benefits. So what exactly can you say is South African policy now vis-a-vis those areas, those regions? And these hopes that we have of leading on the continent, how real is it? How realistic is it? Leadership calls for, you need might and power to put behind that leadership, military power, all of those things, which are costly. Do we see a role for ourselves in that sense? When we have problems in the Eastern Glassy, I mean, we have huge logistic problems, heavy airlift capacity problems, you know, to just carry out one mission. And I remember talking about us taking, you know, leadership and trying to resolve all of the problems in the north. Really, do we have the capacity and the money to do that? Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Perhaps before anyone responds, I would also like to throw just one question. In view of the role that Captain Sanogo is actually playing there, because he seems to be a kingmaker. He installs kings and also deposes them at will. I'm just wondering what kind of a role he is playing, or whether he is involved at all in all these peace, you know, making, you know, initiatives. Because apparently, if he is not actually controlled, he still wields a lot of power to actually undermine whatever we're doing.
Okay, no, that's fine. And then talk to us a little bit about the Kidnapped South African there. Just a bit more information. Okay, now please, in your responses, be as concise as you can for us to save a little bit of time.
Okay, I'm going to be very brief, as you correctly said, and I will just take one or two, then you can ask other invited to complete. And thanks, Honorable Jacobus, for the clarification. I really appreciate it. And now the question of the consistency of the UN, I think it's an Africa-wide concern. There's a thing called national interest. You know, even a civil concern, when people take seats there, it's just national interest. I think this is the thing that influences how people decide national interest. And you are right. Some countries have interest somewhere, and they deploy resources to defend their interest there. No policy, no position in anything can be taken without first address national interest. If it's the interest of my country loses, I will go. So I want to imagine that apart from understood, known conventions and very agreement when it comes to the question of decision is my national interest. But it will be very interesting, Honorable Ngoyama, to see how the Parliament will reflect on this and articulate it even publicly, this concept, because I think you have the obligation to share with our people, on what you think about this situation. So we'll read about that. And I'm sure the press here have taken care of the communication of Ambassador Lembede about President Zuma's response. Now, we thank you, Honorable, for a kind word on our reflection on our presentation. Now, the question of funding, which was raised, I think, by Honorable Ilof and yourself, Alboy, and Honorable Magama, who received this money? It was a pledging conference organized by the AU Commission. So we understand that our money is going to fund by the AU, and the AU will manage that money. Normally they do like that. We have pledging conferences. Last year, the pledging conference in Somalia. So you contribute towards Somalia. And then there is an agreed, without ring-fencing money, it's an agreed that we put this money at the disposal of the commission for the set objective. Nobody said that an objective has been tabulated for that. We have not given the money to, the Mali government, but to the AU institution. And there are other pledging countries besides us in South Africa. Some were even from outside, from the EU, from Turkey, from others, the pledging conference. But also there were donations from Africa, Nigeria, I think Angola and others. So there was a pledge made. We have not yet delivered money. The money is going to come in the African License Fund. I'm not convinced the board is yet, because you see, you convene. Then Jerry, as the chair of the IRA board, I have to convene the board and say the decision. And then we follow the, prescripts. And then, even after we do that, we still go to have concurrent. After the board has settled on this political decision, the minister will then write the Minister of Finance for his concurrent. So it's not reached that stage of concurrent. So the money is still very much in, our shores. Then there was also a question that people are saying, why don't you use part of this money to restore the manuscript in Timbuktu? It's a suggestion that some people are saying that maybe as part of contribution towards Malian life, we should do that. So I don't know, Mother Limbert, there's some question that all of us have raised that you want to reflect on. Including the honourable member sitting next to
you. Oh, sorry. Part of the duty has dealt with satisfaction with the one of contributions and the money that you contributed. I was going to deal with that, but I don't think it's necessary anymore. But to answer the member sitting next to me on Captain Zanogo is a I know it quite well. Captain Sonobo, his role is really very unclear. It's a question that is asked by a lot of people, that how has he been allowed to remain so powerful for so long? And people have different views of why, but I don't think I can sit here and tell you about other people. I don't know why he has remained so powerful. He's a very junior officer in the bigger scheme of things in Mali. He's very, very powerful. He overthrew the government. Actually, ECOWAS had to beg him to step down and offered him that he would recognize as a former head of state. He would get all the benefits of a former head of state if he agrees to step down. And he agreed to step down and set up the traditional government. But it was later withdrawn. It was under pressure from the Western countries. It was later withdrawn. But he really remains very, very powerful. And he remains a destabilizing force in Mali. We are not aware of anybody else in the military who is more powerful than him at the moment, because all senior officers, generals and others were arrested immediately when he took over power. The only force that tried to unseat him was the force that was like a presidential guard, the special forces that were around President Ture when he was. They tried, there was a counter coup in Mali, about 2 months after the first coup. They tried to undo him and they did not succeed. And those are the special forces and they managed to arrest most of them. So, I really don't know. He's very articulate, but he's American trained. And I'm not saying anything on that. A lot of people talk to him a lot when they need to discuss issues in Mali. On the issue of the person who was kidnapped, the South African, his name is Stephen McGowan. McGowan, like a gown. McGowan, yes. He was kidnapped in November 2011 and taken off somewhere in the desert with other foreign nationals. I think there were Swiss, there were other people, French as well, that were kidnapped. There were seven of them. He was found traveling on a British passport, but he's South African. I think he has this dual citizenship, something like that. Then it turned out that he is a South African citizen, because initially both Britain and South Africa were involved in this case, but they've sort of left it to us now. His family is here. We're in constant communication with the family. We share with them whatever little information that we have. They come to the department on a regular basis. His matter was dealt with by a Burkinabe general who was sort of talking to the kidnappers, and they were making some demands and money here, others wanting certain people to be released in prisons in other countries. They wanted to use him as a bargaining chip. But after the French intervention, we lost contact with the kidnappers, and so we don't know what has happened to him. We don't know where he is at the moment. We're just hoping that once the dust settles, they will make contact once again and see what he can do. So that's the situation.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you so much, PG and Ambassador Lebet, for the comprehensive briefing. Perhaps two, three issues. One is there is consensus here that the South African must do everything in its power to ensure that we protect the manuscripts and other historical artifacts that we've worked so hard and spent so much resources on some of them restoring and so on and so on. It's a very important project that we must continue, but we must find a way of protecting whatever is left there. And then we understand the intervention, perhaps understand it as a necessary evil, but consent equally about the symptomatic lack of political will on the part of African leadership, but also on a lack of commitment by the international community on finding a peaceful resolution and speedy reaction to what was happening in Mali. The long-winded approach to the matter is leaves bad taste, quite frankly. It leaves a bad taste because when we compare this to other interventions, in other parts of the African continent, especially in areas which are well endowed with natural resources, I might add, there's a serious contradiction, and that lack of commitment and will to assist and support the processes is exposed. The lack of consistency raised by Honorable Davidson, but in this respect, in terms of dealing, engaging with the situation in Mali by the international community. I think we welcome the support pledged by the South African government, both in terms of the training and so on the one hand, the capacitation, but also in terms of the humanitarian aid, if there's a serious humanitarian crisis and unfolding there. We bemoan the kidnapping of that South African. But I should make this point. You see, there's a pattern that you see in kidnapping of South Africans in many cases, especially on the African continent and in the Middle East. They travel on foreign passports. When they get into trouble, it is the South African government. In fact, some of them having been away from South Africa for many years, because of dual citizenship issues, they get there, get in trouble, and remember that they were South Africans at the time. It's a matter of concern, and it's a matter that we need to, I think as a country, we need to deal with, because it inadvertently draws us into many of the issues in a much more engaged way. than we would have. It's a matter that we, as a country, we will have to look at. But these are our people. We cannot desert them at their hour of need, and we need to engage with the situation nonetheless. And then finally, I think there's the one of the concerns, DG, and you pointed this out, is the lack of a deliberate and conscious attempt to set up these regional standby forces on the part of African leaders to be able to respond immediately, you know, on the spot to problems that that arise in our own backyard. This is a matter that African leadership will have to take up very, very serious, because in almost all conflicts in the African continent, there's always the regional dynamic. There's always a regional dynamic. And well, we wish that our partners in the West, with their intervention in Libya, had listened to us when we said that to them then, that this thing will have as the likely impact of circling out into the rest of the region. They did not listen. And today you have the problems in that part of the region compounded. Of course, there are always problems, but they are compounded. And we need to engage with the situation in that regard. No, thank you so much, Didi. Let's go to the. No, I can't allow you now, Honourable Dudley. No, but we have to move to the next point now on the agenda. Please, let's move now to the next point, Swaziland. Otherwise, we're running way behind schedule. And I hope Didi will use his oratory skills to help us out in terms of the time. And members will have to be very short, very much shorter in your engagement. Thank you.
No, okay. Thanks very much, because now this is a subject that's well known to most members, Swaziland. So I'm going to take around a few minutes to deal with it. The presentation is with you. Now, Swaziland continues to face socio-economic political challenges. In 2000, we saw somewhat compensation as the political challenges were accompanied by economic difficulties. As a result, Swaziland, which is having Peru Saku, revenue started to experience serious problems. Remember, Swaziland gets 60% of its annual budget from Saku revenue. So that is the level of dependence. Now, you know the origin of the problem, Swaziland. You can trace it to 1972, where the former king banned political parties, and even the new constitution, 2006, the new king upheld that banning of political parties. That is the source of concern. I think for 40 years, nobody has been allowed in Swaziland. So any more political parties, as well as the occasional opposition party and civil society leader, have led to escalation of tension in the country until today. So chief among the demands of the movement, Podem, NCA and others, is the unbanning of political parties in Swaziland. So in response, the number of opposition parties, the Swazi authorities have over the years promulgated various security legislation, including anti-terrorism and sedition legislation. That's how they responded to the demand for unbanning of political parties. The Swazi authorities tend to resort to the use of force to clamp down on protests. And as we speak, change remains very, very, very tense. Of course, it did attract international attention. In terms of the economy, Swaziland is part of a monetary union, although they've got their own currency, the tax on the rand, and they receive 85% of its support from South Africa and export 85% of their export to South Africa. They still very much calculate the revenue because of that. It exports to us asbestos, coal, cotton, cast diamonds, mineral, paper, and timber. Of course, we import a lot of, we export a lot of products. Now, one of us recall that in 2010-2011, Swaziland received only 1.9 billion revenue compared to 5.1 billion in 2010. So revenue fell because of economic problems. global economic crisis of 2009. But last year, December, they let us, no, you can keep your money, we don't need it, because we gave it about 1 billion from the revenue, so they don't need the money now. They are fine. I know all members raised this issue so many times. What are the conditions? No, they said, no, no, no. Keep your rent, we keep our. What is the currency there? Now, but still, that does not solve the problem long term. Because when they approached the IMF, and they approached us, we agreed with the IMF on certain areas that they must do. Then they produced this fiscal adjustment roadmap, as an intervention strategy. But our assessment is that they have not implemented it. So if they come back again, revenue fall like 2009, and then we reduce revenue, we are going to have the same problem once and more. However, what they agreed was to increase tax collection and reduce VAT and fuel levy. That's what they have. And we hope that that will help them to attract a bit of revenue. But other targets have not been met, especially the wage bill. Reduce size and free salary increase. You know, they've got the huge budget bureaucracy. They already touched that. And then they got so many ministries for that country. They said, no, we don't touch it. And the most delicate one, to reduce the king's household spending. So those you cannot touch. Now, what we are with Swaziland, we discussed with them again, because we always prepare for the inequity. Plan B for Swaziland. The 2.4 billion loan that we signed with them, we say these are sort of the issue that you need to address, look at, especially political dialogue, criminal reform. That was the core of our suggestions to them, that we do that. Political dialogue. They have not done that. But we have not removed the loan on the table. So it's still there. If you want it, come to the party. We will do that. Now, also this difficult is the implementation of the fiscal roadmap, because basically if we do that, it will have a transition on the public service and add more unemployment. It's around, we are 60% unemployment in Swaziland. So that's what I'm holding on to the public service as it is. And they say, okay, anyway, if you cut the public service bill, well, open your borders because they will be coming over. They will head to South Africa. So we will do our best, but be careful that they will do that. They will come to South Africa. Notwithstanding the security clampdown, the banned political parties are expected to continue calling for democratization. We don't see the end to that demand. And then it seems everything is clear that they're going to call for the boycott of elections this year. We don't see the revival of the economy. So all political plane members, we think it's going to be the same, if not slightly worse. On the economy front, the crisis will continue because the IMF seems not to be convinced to open up its envelope because Swaziland has not fulfilled some of the conditions that they gave them. The government has improved the governance so that they can then manage their fiscal policy and then ensure tax collection. They have to have a separate economy. I don't know whether they will really be able to attract more foreign investment. Of course, we see some presidents there, like presidents of Guinea, Equatorial Guinea goes there, Obiang, Taiwanese goes there, so maybe there are at least some foreign investors in South. In conclusion, Swaziland will continue to face economic and political challenges. And they may need help to do this thing. I think they will need a lot of help. There should be a support from the region to keep it at least stable. Whether the Swaziland government will be ready for negotiation or to have to facilitate, I will not honorable members. But we think that there is a need to engage both parties so that we can change the environment. It's the only country in SADC where political parties are banned. Political parties are banned. I mean, even countries like the DRC, so much problems, the parties are not banned, but political parties are banned. So, perhaps all the members, in your reflection, do want to look into this. This is a real, real concern for us. It's not a movement in the political platform. Dorothy, in short, all the members, so we can then wait for your questions. Thanks.
Let me start with Honorable Sullivan, and then Jacobus. Davidson.
Okay. Thank you, Honorable Chair. Last year, as far as we were big financial problems, IMF didn't, didn't take a loan of the IMF in South Africa also. Now, I've got a suspicion that some other countries out there, do you have any information regarding that? Because how can they survive? They couldn't pay the civil service last year. I would also like to add that Swaziland is a neighbor country of Africa. Any problems here will have an influence on us. What else can we possibly do that they can become more of a political free country and unbanning a political party? Because it is not true to the democracy there, as we can see it. Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson. If I just go to page, I think it's page 2, under the introduction. The dependence of Swaziland on their revenue, over 6%, from the SACU budget. Isn't there a pressure we can put on Swaziland then, you know, as SACU, to say that, well, there are conditions and all of that, but to put pressure and to say, number one, and ban the political parties, because that is not on. And also as a fellow SADC country, we know that the banning of political parties didn't get us very far. So that must be one of the conditions as well. On page 4, where we talk about the authorities that will use force to clamp down a protest, I mean, that also didn't get South Africa very far, because force was used, but here we are in democracy today. It doesn't stop people to continue with protests and all of that. Rather, it is the issue at hand. On page 9, where we say that the offer is still on the table, why don't we just withdraw the offer and put those other conditions and say, look, you know, because they clearly, according to the presentation, are not interested anymore. So we just withdraw. It might be a heavy-handed approach, but we just withdraw the offer. Don't leave it on the table. Thanks, Chair.
Yeah, Ms. Kimna, you know, I must differ, although I sympathize with my colleague, because I think that South African policy is being entirely consistent. Yes, we have a renegade state in our midst, and yes, if we look at our own constitution, which promotes certain values, part of which is democracy and human rights, I have big sympathy with what the Honourable Member is saying. But we didn't take that approach as far as Zimbabwe is concerned. So why do we take it as far as Swaziland is concerned? I would agree with you. We should actually intervene. I've got no problem with South Africa exercising hegemonic tendencies in the SADC region, or particularly in SACU. But then we must be consistent. You can't motivate a case for movement against the Swaziland government as you have. At the state stage, retrospectively, not done the same as far as Zimbabwe is concerned. So I think Zirko has been entirely consistent as far as this is concerned. My own gut reaction would be exactly the same as yours. We need to exercise some sort of authority as the leading country in certainly SACU and even SADC, and actually turn the screws on them, to be bluntly. But we haven't done it in the past, and we can't choose, we can't cherry pick. We either must be consistent or do what we're doing now and in fact trying to get them around the negotiating table, which is the option which I think Dirk and the South African government is kind of extraditing, but it's probably soft power to do so. So in that context, that's all I have to say, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Chair. My constituency, a political constituency, boundary extends to the border of Swaziland. And let me inform my colleagues here in this house that when I visit some of the towns that are there on the borders, this is what they tell me. They say to me that when it is time for pension to be collected, they are coming by their thousands and the droves across the border down the mountains, coming into the cities and towns, collecting monies, belongs to our solitary taxpayers, doing a hell of a lot of shopping, and then they just go back. Now the question is, why should we as a country be sustaining their citizenry and their people when their leader, the king, doesn't care about his own people? That's the question. As a country, as my colleague has said before me, we say that there are certain values and principles that informs our foreign policy, and one of them is consideration of human rights, freedom, etc. Now, why can't we be a country consistent? And you have the political will that says this is what it is, and this is how it will be. But we tolerate this, this king who continues to oppress his people, and then they have over 40% joblessness, and then they come and become a burden on our own social security and our own institutional setup. And all we do is, have this carrot and stick thing. We just loan for you, but you got to do this or you got to do that. And they say, bugger off, we don't want it anymore. I mean, come on. Something to think about. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Chairman.
No, this is simply an observation, really. I'm not sure where it would come a question. I look at Swaziland and the discussions we just had now, but Swaziland also really is one of those African nation states which could not escape the predicament of the post-colonial situation. Mr. Gonyama and Honorable Gonyama and Honorable Boyd raised an issue of the motivation when it came to Mali, which what motivates these conflicts, whether it's political ideologies or it's the religious doctrine. Now, too often there is always a failure of that assessment. Even when you look at the convergence of the West at the moment and converging with the East into the African situation, whether the Europe is led by the U.S. and China leads the Asian and forces, they are crazy what the ambassador said earlier on, that they look at their national interest first before they can look at assess what motivates the conflict. And therefore, this is where the failure is. But I think we did in the past, Your Excellency, look at Swaziland also and say, if we're going to go into an inclusive political dialogue, then some of us were saying that South Africa ought to put together a special envoy of people with different interests, which would resonate in what is happening in Swaziland. For instance, we were saying that an inclusive political dialogue, which would include the king, the council, the political parties, the NGOs, the churches, and other stakeholders in Swaziland. But then we would look at what we would say the harmonic constitutional arrangement, which would cater for other political institutions, for instance, given that democracy is a political institution. Now, there are other political institutions which need to be considered. For instance, the aristocracy. That is a political institution which is there in Swaziland. The monarchy is a political institution that exists in Swaziland. Then you have your democracy with your legislature, executive, and judiciary. Now, that is a harmonic arrangement which we need for Swaziland. As I see at the moment. Otherwise, what we're trying to do at the moment is your prognosis and your conclusion, I say it all, that it's a collapsing state. So my plea really would be for South Africa to look at this kind of a special envoy. There are people in this country who are knowledgeable about aristocracy, who are knowledgeable about monarchy,
who are knowledgeable about democracy itself in this country. So we need to dispatch that kind of special envoy into Swaziland. I know you have an ambassador in Swaziland, but ambassadors are administrators. They do administration really most of the time about the interests of the country, economy, and that. They don't tell the king what to do, and so they don't advise the king. I would not plead for that, to Your Excellency. That. Let's look at that.
Okay. DJ?
Can you help me with some of the issues I'm not be able to answer? Now, the question that comes through is, what can we do to assist the political process? Because all of us, I think, are concerned about the situation. Honourable members gave a number of suggestions on how to resolve the situation. It ranged from why don't we, like Honourable Jacobus was saying, make use of this revenue formula that agreed in 1902, more than 100 years ago, and reviewed 5 years ago, the new sharing formula, when the circus was established. Why don't we use that as a backing or as a way of encouraging them to rescind the 1973 decree, the political parties, and to open up the constitution, reviewing the chapter on political parties in 2006, that to open that chapter with a view to accommodate political parties. Maybe along to what Marcus was another thing, that we have a particular unique characteristic here of a country which is monarchy, as a teacher. Some honorable Kosana were saying, what do you like? They do like the suit. It's a monarchy also. But it does have a constitutional democracy. Why don't we? So there have been a few of thought. The suit is very difficult. We have the same size or population like this was then, in our neighbors, but they have democratic processes. But the king deals with the supreme. So there were a number of suggestions. So there is a bit of thinking, but it has to do with the speech we all on. So then we're saying like an envoy or put a group together to go and discuss. But I can imagine, when this was drafted in 2005, they came for assistance. So they said, no, this chapter like that, this chapter like this, or this like that. So maybe, I don't know what I'm saying collectively, we need to ask them to make a reflection on that question. So that is one question which I think the other members have got us on. The second one, in Swaziland, Lesotho, Botswana, and Mozambique, dependency on the South African security, social security. I'm sure you are aware that close to the city of Lesotho come over for a grant. Millions of Mozambican cross over, Botswana come over, and Swaziland. So you have a couple of Namibia also. In 1998, you recall, there was a second sensation made that all those who lived in South Africa, worked here for so many years, can come to claim what is very this country. But also the phenomenon of those of health reasons, that most of them have their kids in South Africa. And then, of course, that. But the most important one, Honorable Sharp, when you go to Swaziland, in the area of most of them have great fishing land. You know, we are in areas, I remember, where the king of Swaziland come and install ships in South Africa. Otherwise, we cannot be a ship. We have institutions in the Free State where the king of Lesotho come over to his house and install the ship. Except in Botswana, Botswana ships come here and install, and that's better. They move from here and install that. So, I said at that time to the committee, for us, Christian integration is a living thing. Sometimes when they don't go to that border. No, they jump the fence. Come to any this side, they go to the other side. So, citizenship is not only Europeans, even among us. For us, we practice it. And hence, you see so many of them have an ID. So many of them have an ID. So you cannot deny them, because they have an ID. So many of them have got 7 IDs. So I think maybe we need to reflect on the question, larger question. For me, it's a larger question. You have an audit and say from this date, no other person come and collect the revenue here or not. Now, on the other one, very, very quickly, on the issue that raised by Honorable Davidson on consistency, Zimbabwe and Swaziland, I think that's one we must debate among ourselves. Bureaucrats normally don't answer that terrain. There is a terrain most of us are going to go to watch, to observe a referendum now in Zimbabwe, and then go for the election. And also going to send to Swaziland. So, Madam, I think you are committed to go to Swaziland for the re-election. Then they will go to Zimbabwe. And then maybe Robert Davidson can reflect as he moves around Zimbabwe around Swaziland, can make No, they won't. They would dine him and then think for the And then the issue that was raised about the off on the table of the law. You know, Zimbabwe is a very consistent country. I think one of just reflect from September 1994. We're a very consistent country. We don't easily withdraw our commitment. We tend to stay with our commitment. You can go back and see the series of what we committed wrong. We don't cheat in our house. During better times, during bad times, we stay around. Now, our neighbor, you know, there is an African saying, I don't know how to put it in English, but you know, in the African tradition, this is my father's place, they make them call with a blend of trees, call for cattle. And then even the yard, you know, this is my yard, it's a yard, yard are made of friendship. Even then, if this one caught fire, the whole corps would catch fire. The whole corps of yard will cause fire. Now, that says there's a lot of meaning. Because the land is our neighbor. And sometimes, Honorable Davidson, you reflect on the kind of measures. But see, bureaucrats are taught one thing. You have to tell us how we go out, not how we go in. We go in, but before we decide, tell us how we're going to go out. And that's what bureaucrats are paid for. In fact, even guerrillas are paid like that. The guerrillas say, if you go and bomb, we must want to go out. Otherwise, don't bomb. If you don't know where you're going to go out. So I think it's from the guerrilla warfare system also. Now, I know what they we're reflecting, I know what they okay, if we draw from Swaziland, this one, they say, no, not now, because we are okay, we have 7.1 billion, 2012-2018, so we are okay. Now, if we draw those commitments, our thinking has been very bureaucratic. Our thing was that it's on the table, and we still tell them you need to move towards political negotiations. You have to invent political parties. You have to create a situation where some people can realize their dream of being free, while respecting the king and the stock of Zimbabwe. Because we didn't see the contradiction between politically free and even the king. We didn't see that. And that's why I thought around my government to just to conclude, that could be maybe the approach. As Africans, we have chiefs of kings. Even our own area, we still have them. But we have political attraction. We have political parties and councils, but we still go to the chief, we still go to the king. There's no contradiction whatsoever. I think that's what you're saying. Why don't other political parties? Because we don't connect. Even if they say that, there's a lot of certifying. But it does not contradiction. And then political parties. Maintain the monarchy. Of course, constitutional monarchy. So you have to reform the monarchy. You have to. I think this is the core of the problem. Rakosan, can we reform the monarchy in Zimbabwe? Can we become constitutional? I think to me that's the core. Where are the constitutional institutions going to address that question? Towards constitutional monarchy. with your experience and knowledge and neighborhood, perhaps all these things are done quite.
One of the questions that was asked is, did Swaziland get money from any other bank?
Yes.
Now, of course, there's been lots of speculation, both in the Swaziland media and a little in South Africa as well. But we can't go on to that speculation. And you would note also that we reported that when South Africa did ask for the loan book of Swaziland, not because we nosy, but because we help, our treasury wanted to assist them to restructure repayments and so forth. That part of the negotiations were never concluded. I'm going to go back a little. The memorandum of understanding that South Africa and Swaziland signed about the $2.4 billion already contained the political agreement. And actually, Swaziland signed that without changing it at all. It's important to note that the aspect of it that that was the precondition for actual funds to be transferred was a further financial conditions agreement and a central bank to reserve bank agreement. And that one took a long time because literally our treasury sat with Swaziland and looking at the IMF program and one of the IMF suggestions, they were busy going with Swaziland. Response one, what are you going to do with this money? How do we spend it? The whole idea was to help Swaziland to regain financial fitness. And when we look back now, we can actually account for how they managed to regain financial fitness. They didn't take all of the lessons from the IMF. They didn't take all of the lessons from what they were busy discussing with Treasury, but together with the SALCO revenue, it actually helped them. So they've already started instituting lots of financial reforms. It's that final step that the IMF requires and maybe that we might also require at a future stage when we get to that discussion. But it's important to note they agreed to the political conditions that we set for the loan. It's just the financial issues that needed fine-tuning.
No, thank you. Thank you so much. That's just a last one. I can't add more. There is no contradiction between having a constitutional monarchy and granting people political freedom. Absolutely no. It's been done all over the world. And Swaziland is not a test case. It's been proven to work. The use of force against protests is indeed a very serious matter. And I think as a parliament, we need to find a response to these kinds of this kind of thing. And of course, together with the fact that you know there's no political political parties banned and so on remain. But broadly, I think last year already the committee has expressed its support for the quotations set out by our government. Clearly identified these as embracing the constitutional values of South Africa and will help us pursue a more stable and free static region, which is a critical precondition for the building of a stronger, in fact, for the advancement of broadly what we refer to as African agenda. A stable static status that is very important. You know, quite concerning the key state of the nation address is only reference to any political instability in its own country, basically two lines. In the entire state of the nation address, where it basically said that as a collective, we refuse to listen to the divisive voices and remain resolute towards our convictions. That's the only reference, to anything being wrong in the country. It is concerning because it's indicative of His Majesty's thinking, how he engages with the issue of
what they call in other countries civil and political rights. You know, his engagement was quite concerning. And clearly it's going to be an uphill battle. You know, sometimes there are many organizations, and these organizations are trying to pursue, to agitate for a peaceful and inclusive dialogue of the Swahili people to determine their own constitutional dispensation, which is key and critical. And as a South African parliament, it's incumbent upon us to support those efforts, you know, at finding a lasting solution, especially because we are directly, as pointed out by the team, we are directly affected by what is happening. And we do not claim that Swaziland is, you know, part of South Africa. No, it's not. In fact, we have made the commitment that we will defend the territorial integrity of Swaziland and other countries. You know, in the old, almost said CBDC state, what do you call it? Your Swaziland, Botswana, yes, the BRS state. We've made that commitment. We're committed to that as a country. So they are not, however, we cannot pretend that what is happening in Swaziland doesn't happen. In fact, as pointed out by the PG, there are several crises on the other side of the border. You know, there are people who went to PG, who, now, my town is a border town, right, border in Namibia. But we are just over 1,000 kilometers away from Bandung, the capital of Namibia. There are people coming to receive grants and fires from this. You know? I know personally of at least two individuals that come in Paish or Shakar in the south of Namibia. Now from Abington, that's about almost that, more than 2,000 kilometers. Coming to receive a grant of just over 1,000. And so the point is that what's happening in the countries affects us in a real way. So while we should be sensitive, while we should, you know, pursue our values, which we believe are universal values, but we should also be sensitive to, you know, how we interact, you know, with the situation in any of these given countries. And I've heard some members raising the issue of quiet diplomacy, whatever that means. But I thought that was already dealt with in the sense that somebody, in fact, I think it was the former president, said, you said, but by very nature, diplomacy is quiet. You don't jump on the rooftop and shout and think you'll attain anything. But it's important that we engage with the sensitive, of course, to this issue, but we find you know, ways of assisting the process along. And our approach is that to be what is commonly referred to as a bailout in the program approach. And that, you know, the situation not turned around in the manner that it did, we would probably have made some gains in that regard. So you have our support in that regard today, and so on going forward. Honorable members, thank you very much. I just have one announcement to make. But let me thank you, PG, and your team for these briefings. We challenge always is how we will engage with the issue going forward as Parliament. That is, and it's good to hear, PG, that you will be extending an invite to the committee to take part in this observer mission. We are very delighted with that opportunity. I know that there are internal processes in Parliament itself, but I'm sure we'll be able to deal with those. Thank you so much. And thank you so much for the rest of our guests and the honorable members. Now, on the issue related to the visit to Israel and Palestine. You are in